This is Artistic Director Martha Levy, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Audio Program. Steppenwolf Theater Company presents Fake, written and directed by ensemble member Eric Simonson, featuring Kate Arrington, Coburn Goss, Francis Guinan, Alan Wilder, and Larry Yando. We open our season of Belief with Fake, a new play by ensemble member Eric Simonson. Fake follows two narratives, one set in 1914, the other in 1953. Both narratives take place in East Sussex and in London and are linked by the story of Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was the artifact discovered in East Sussex, purported to be the missing link, the evidence of an evolutionary link between Cro-Magnon and modern man. In the earlier story, set at the time of the artifact's discovery, the characters are historical personages, gathered together by the novelist, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Like his most famous literary creation, Sherlock Holmes, Doyle gathers a cast of characters in a drawing room, confident that the pressure of their being together will uncover the truth of what he believes is a hoax. The 1914 story is an inscription of the whodunit structure of Doyle's famous novels. These scenes from 1914 alternate with scenes from 1953, the year that Piltdown Man was revealed to be a fake. The characters in the 1953 story are analogues to their 1914 counterparts, and although they continue the narrative of the Piltdown Man discovery and unmasking, the focus of their story shifts to the interpersonal. The questions of authenticity, the tension between religious and scientific belief, the questions about what is known and what it is impossible to know take on a decidedly personal cast. In Piltdown Man, Eric has discovered a potent symbol by which to test our convictions about belief, authenticity, science, the spiritual. What do we do as a species, as individuals, when reality feels discontinuous, when a leap of evolutionary development demands evidence or a leap of faith? Because both of the stories in the play, the one set in 1914 and the one in 1953, are constructed as mysteries, I resist describing their plots and their outcomes. Rather, I alert you to the multiple dualities in the play that form the central core of the play's theme. The central image of the play is the Piltdown Man artifact itself. The skull is a hybrid structure. The cranium suggests an evolutionary advance over its lower part, the mandible, which is closer in structure to the jaw of an ape. The image of the skull, suggested of the evolution of human consciousness, becomes a potent symbol of man's dual nature, a residue of our animal past, a suggestion of our capacity for higher-level thought and ideation. Eric mimics this conjoining of past and present in his structure of the play. He gives us two moments in history and allows the story to oscillate between them. The narrative of the play is not a simple chronology. We move back and forth in time with the present moment of your receiving it, a double vision. As an audience, we are watching two stories in parallel, each informing the other. Like the skull of Piltdown Man, the story of Fake allows us to see the past and present conjoined in a single creation. Another set of oppositions is provided by the characters within each narrative. Both storylines pose a mystery, and the characters in each are charged with solving the mystery at hand. In the 1914 narrative, the British fiction writer Doyle is paired with Rebecca Eastman, an American journalist. They, in turn, are positioned against an historian, Arthur Woodward. Fiction, journalism, and history, each a different take on narrative, each committed to a version of the truth. Joining them are a scientist, Charles Darwin, and a philosopher-theologian, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, another oppositional pairing of truth-seekers. As we come to discover, each of them has a personal stake in the prosecution of their point of view. Each calls into service the methodology and the bias of their profession, to substantiate the truth claims that their personal and emotional history demands. In the 1953 storyline, the characters are, again, representatives of various and oppositional narrative starting points. Jonathan is an atheist and an academic who relies on the examination of historical artifacts to construct the evolutionary record. Jonathan's faith is deductive logic. His young colleague, American Doug Arndt, works more directly in the field. He engages the objects and sites themselves. He subjects them to clinical examination and testing. He speculates. As he says to Kat, Jonathan's fiancée and herself an anthropologist, "I don't fit in with the smart set. I think you can get bogged down with the deductions, you know, lose the big picture. There's more to life than artifacts and figures, don't you think?"
"Like what?" Kat asks.
"I don't know," he says.
"Mystery?"
With the Piltdown Man artifact serving as the central image in both storylines of the play, we watch this array of characters negotiate the mystery of origins through the construction of oppositional narratives. The question that the Piltdown Man artifact provokes about the origin of the species activates in each of them a kind of self-excavation. The convictions that have been formed by the characters' personal histories becomes the informing narratives of their systems of inquiry about the world. We develop systems of thought, disciplinary narratives, science, religion, journalism, that seek primacy as the most complete, the most reliable, the truest. But those narratives are always informed by our personal stake in the outcome. I think Fake is a wonderfully provocative starting point for our season of belief. We want to know. We want the truth, and we construct systems of thought, tenets of belief, to address the mysteries that elude our ability to gain those certainties. The past of our own lives, of our species' life, is a profound mystery that will always fascinate and always elude. Deep at the heart of that fascination and that elusiveness is a duality. We live in the animal kingdom we call our past. We live in a mind capable of imagining a transcendence and a future. Perhaps, like the story of Fake, an authentic view of our human condition will always require a double vision, a parallel storyline of past and present, religion and science, logic and mystery, doubt and faith.
The reality behind Fake. Interview with playwright and director Eric Simonson and associate artistic director David New. Tim McCarthy as David New.
And Gabe Levinson as Eric Simonson.
Eric, your play Fake contains historical figures and scenarios. What are the permissions and constraints as a playwright when you are using actual people and events as a jumping-off place? Do you feel free to create something new? Is there an obligation to remain somewhat true to historical accounts?
I do a fair bit of research of the play as characters from history, and I try my best to capture the essence of any real person. But the story in Fake is pretty much made up, so I take a fair amount of artistic license. We're talking about famous people who lived over 100 years ago. There's no way of knowing how they moved, what they sounded like, and it's impossible to capture any person absolutely. In the end, you know, and after I'd done most of the research, I put away the books and I tried to write from the right side of the brain. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. When you begin writing a play like Fake, do you envision directing it as well? Do you have a directorial point of view as you're writing the play?
The more I write plays, the more I try to make them accessible to any director. So I think my work has become more literary, that is, less dependent on scenery and stage directions. I've also been writing plays with smaller casts and smaller scenes, which helps make richer characters, ones that an actor might have a better time with. At least that's my intention.
Well, you've certainly created some rich roles for actors in Fake. Where did the inspiration for the play originate?
I was flipping through TV channels one night a few years ago. One of the programs had a documentary on the mystery of Piltdown Man, and the documentary made a compelling case for why, in this case, fact was stranger than fiction, or at least fact was as strange as fiction, in that there was this mystery out there that no one had yet solved, and that mystery had real characters with interesting motivations. The subject seemed ripe for drama. Also, I've always been interested in paradigms of revolution in science. Like before the Earth was discovered to be round, it was universally thought flat. And then a scientist proved this wrong. that completely undermined what we believe of our real world, and we had to start over again. We're forever trying to find the truth about the world around us, and forever having the rug pulled out from under us. We know this, and yet we never stop searching for the truth.
In the play, the character Doug says, "Nothing can be proven ever in the world. We think we have everything down, we think we get it all right, and then poof, something comes along and smashes it all to bits. Then we start all over again."
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. And there's also the fact that we are obsessed with investigating ourselves, that is, as a species, as a part of the natural world. And everybody's idea of what is real is completely different. Also, and this is an idea that comes from evolutionary theory, scientists believe that we have evolved into animals who are hardwired to be curious beings. Even if we tried, we'd never stop trying to solve mysteries. It's in our nature. And our curiosity plays a large part in discovering worlds both seen and unseen. New theories in science, new religions, our belief in God or gods are all a result of our innate urge to explore the world around us. It's a survival instinct, really. When I was researching the play, I read a lot about Darwin. I read a biography or two on Doyle. I was reading contemporary pieces on evolution, a lot of science essays, books about evolutionary science, Jesuit philosophy and Catholicism. And it was also a time during which I experienced a significant personal loss. So I had a lot of serious questions about the world around me that I'd never asked for myself about what I believe.
Was it defining for you in terms of what you believe, what you have faith in?
Yes, actually. I decided that it's pretty much impossible to know a world outside of our own personal experiences and memories, and that actually may be okay.
One of the things you explore in the play, and I think there are three instances where this is the case, is that an encounter with death can amplify or sometimes diminish those systems we've created for ourselves.
Yes, there's mourning throughout the play.
See, I think that's interesting because you're making a connection between the evolutionary need to create these systems for ourselves and the fact that evolution is tied to the cycle of death. That's why it's constantly ongoing. Discoveries are constantly being made, and old beliefs are constantly being smashed. It's all part of the cycle, right?
Yes, it goes back to this notion of our curious nature. We are hunters and gatherers, or used to be anyway. We're not like the koala bear who only needs eucalyptus leaves and he's good for the day, or, say, the snake who only needs a mouse. Humans must digest and get nutrition from a number of sources, and evolution has made us multitaskers. We are born with the ability to find berries, hunt for animals, determine the best way to catch a fish all at once. This is how we became curious beings. And this evolutionary talent propels us into a world of not just hunting and gathering, but investigating all sorts of things, including ourselves and the rest of the universe. We're drawn to mystery, and death is the greatest mystery of all.
It's fascinating. What are you looking forward to, and what do you think might be the challenges as you enter the rehearsal process?
I'm looking forward to working with the ensemble, with my talented cast. Martha Levy, Eric Daniels, and I took a great deal of care putting this group together, and I feel like I'm going to be able to really hear the play the way I hear it in my head. And it's a lot of fun to create something you feel passionate about, and something that's never been done before. The challenges are going to be the usual challenges of putting up a new play, making sure the story's heard clearly, that the thoughts are fresh. There are a lot of themes to the play. If I can spin a good yarn and illuminate at least a couple of those ideas, I'll be happy. The Mystery of Piltdown Man by artistic intern Knud Adams. Is it possible that Charles Dawson, an amateur archaeologist, discovered one of the most important finds of the 20th century? That's what he claimed to the Geological Society of London in 1912, and Arthur Smith Woodward, an expert from the British Museum, backed his story. Together, they presented Piltdown Man, an ancient skull that seemingly proved that humans evolved from apes. Dawson began excavating the Piltdown Quarry 4 years earlier, after workmen found mysterious bone fragments amongst the gravel. Dawson enlisted the help of Woodward and paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who, like Dawson and Piltdown Man, loom large in Eric Simonson's play Fake. Together, they unearthed the most unusual skull, with a brain two-thirds the size of a modern man's and a chimpanzee-like jaw. Equally exciting, Piltdown Man was found on English soil, suggesting that the first humans were British. Almost immediately following Dawson's presentation, Piltdown Man fell under attack. Prominent French and American scientists were skeptical of the reconstruction. They argued that the skull and jaw might have come from separate species. However, these critics couldn't explain the fact that the pieces were discovered within feet of each other, or the identical coloration of the samples. Accusations of a mistaken reconstruction were silenced when the Piltdown site provided additional skull fragments and teeth that supported Dawson's theory. While an accidental mix-up proved unlikely, some believed Piltdown Man to be a deliberate hoax. Who would perpetrate such a fraud? The list of suspects included Charles Dawson, Arthur Smith Woodward, and Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, as well as notorious trickster William Horace de Vere Cole, author Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and evolutionist Sir Arthur Keith. Or perhaps this was a national conspiracy? Was the first Briton falsified in order to surpass French and German finds? How was such a convincing specimen created? What about the human-like molars in a chimpanzee-sized jaw, or the authentic aging effects? These questions lingered for decades. Finally, in 1953, new methods of chemical dating allowed scientists to accurately assess the validity of the bones, and the true nature of Piltdown Man was revealed. In the Throes of Crisis, by artistic intern Knud Adams. Ensemble member Eric Simonson's play Fake draws upon historical figures, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who lived during a time of philosophical and scientific revolution. This upheaval began in 1859, when Charles Darwin published his controversial theory of natural selection. Darwin's work instigated new scientific approaches to answering existential questions and complicated man's perception of his identity. While Darwin rejected religion and turned towards science, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle sought to reaffirm his spiritual faith. However, the beliefs of both men were shaped by personal crisis and loss. Charles Darwin was raised in a religious household. He was baptized, he attended church weekly, and he boarded at an Anglican school. He went on to study at Christ's College, where he worked toward becoming a clergyman. After graduating, he seized the opportunity to sail with the HMS Beagle. He hoped to travel the world before continuing his religious career. During this life-altering voyage, Darwin observed the natural phenomena that shook his already wavering belief in the creation story. By his return, he had committed his life to scientific investigation and the theory of natural selection. Darwin married a religious woman, his cousin, Emma Wedgwood, and together they had 10 children. While raising his family, he continued his scientific experimentation and drifted further from the church. His most beloved daughter died at age 9. This crisis shattered Darwin's remaining faith, and he ceased attending services. Every Sunday, he left his family at the church gate to wander the surrounding countryside. Upon Darwin's death in 1882, his wife censored atheistic passages from his autobiography. For instance, he had written, "Thus disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress, and have never since doubted even for a single second that my conclusion was correct." Although Darwin described his journey to atheism as being rational and gradual, history suggests that it was impelled by the loss of a child. As Darwin's theories shook firmly held religious beliefs, many hoped Spiritism would scientifically prove the existence of an afterlife. One such believer was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Although Doyle's tombstone reads, "Knight, patriot, physician, and man of letters," he is most remembered for his stories featuring Sherlock Holmes. Authoring dozens of mysteries, Doyle was somewhat of a detective himself. He investigated supernatural phenomena. After losing his brother, mother, and son, he became obsessed by matters of the occult and spiritism. Followers of spiritism believe that trained mediums communicate with the dead, and they gathered for seances and spectacular demonstrations of hypnotism, automatic writing, and poltergeist visitations. Spiritism spread widely across Europe and the United States during the later half of the 19th century. By 1897, it had attracted over 8 million followers. Many of Spiritism's most ardent supporters had lost a loved one. Mary Todd Lincoln held seances in the White House to contact her deceased son. Indeed, interest in Spiritism spiked after the Civil War and World War I, both periods of great loss. Spiritist philosophers appropriated from Darwin's theories, postulating that spirits evolve in the afterlife by ascending through a series of purifying spheres before joining God. They used Darwin's model of natural selection to describe this purgatory-like journey.
Darwin himself attended a séance in 1874, but he was unimpressed by the spectacle of sparks and levitating furniture. Later he wrote, "The Lord have mercy on us if we have to believe such rubbish." While Darwin remained skeptical of spiritism, other men of intellect, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, were among its greatest champions. Doyle went so far as to launch an American lecture tour in which he shared documentation of seances and spirit photography. These convincing slides inspired screams, fainting, and even suicide. Fantastical creatures, such as the Cottingley fairies, also fascinated Doyle. These fairies were photographed by two young girls, who took turns posing with the elegant winged creatures in their backwoods. Doyle published the photographs and defended their validity. 50 years after his death, the women admitted to fabricating the images with paper cutouts, but they insisted they had seen real fairies. They only created the fakes to get back at the adults who had disbelieved their genuine discovery. Doyle also touted his friend Harry Houdini as evidence of the supernatural. Although Houdini explained that his magic tricks were merely physical feats, Doyle insisted the magician possessed otherworldly powers. Their friendship ended when Doyle arranged a séance to contact Houdini's recently deceased mother. After a medium generated a heartfelt letter in English from his mother's ghost, Houdini revealed that she had only spoken Hungarian and Yiddish, and he denounced the séance as a sham. Doyle and Houdini stopped speaking, and their enmity manifested itself in a battle of hostile letters waged through the press. Defying criticism, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle remained a resolute believer until his death in 1929. While the death of his child hastened Darwin's rejection of Christianity, Doyle's loss inspired a lasting faith in spiritism and the afterlife. Wounded by personal loss, both men sought to reinvestigate fundamental questions of faith. Who are we, and why do we exist? Designer's Notebook. Fake is set in two time periods separated by several decades, 1914 and 1953. We invited Karin Kopischke, costume designer for Fake, to share her secrets for making those decades disappear in seconds. In her own words, Fake is about the discovery of the Piltdown man's skull in 1914 England and the subsequent proof that it was a hoax 4 decades later in 1953. 5 actors portray 5 characters from each decade. The 1914 characters are based on historical figures, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and the 1953 characters present a fictionalized account of the uncovering and confirmation of the hoax. The play jumps back and forth between the 2 decades, with the actors each jumping back and forth between their 2 characters. The 1914 characters live in an Edwardian world. The colors are dark and saturated, the textures are rich and plush, the atmosphere is full of mystery and intrigue. By contrast, the 1953 characters exist in the scientifically carbon-dating age. The colors are bright and modern mid-century pastels, the textures are cold and steely, the lines are clean and spare. This world is stark and rational. Playwright-director Eric Simonson and I didn't want to go to extreme lengths to fool the audience about the actors' transformations, but we did want each character to be immediately recognizable within their world and time period. The costume changes themselves need to convey the period, but happen almost instantaneously. For example, ensemble member Kate Arrington transforms from Rebecca Eastman, 1914, to Katerina, 1953, and back to Rebecca again. To make those transitions seamless, I'm trying to incorporate what Kat wears on Rebecca's costume. We see a little bit of Kat coming through at the neckline, which will add a nice little touch to Rebecca's suit. The change from Rebecca to Kat involves literally opening up the jacket and taking it off, then opening up the skirt and taking it off. Technically, it's a fun, quick change, and hopefully, it's magical. When Eric wrote the play, he just wanted the 2 decades and the 2 groups of people to tell the story. He really didn't see a specific connection between characters through actor doubling. But I think we, as audience members, are going to look for that. I like the very subtle touch of there being a little bit of texture and color that is a constant between Rebecca and Kat. The 2 are very strong women. They're ahead of their time. Maybe there wasn't a connection when he was writing it, but there is one subliminally or subconsciously. I imagine that Kate Arrington will explore how these women are similar, but also how they are different.
Overthinking the Play by Director of Artistic Development, Polly Carl. I've always liked to think too much, or so I've been told. For the past 11 years, the subject I've spent the most time thinking about is new plays in the American theater. Along with the work itself, the pages, set designs, performances, thinking about the American theater means engaging with the world in a particular and compelling way. The theater opens me up to the world of ideas, politics, art, the three basic thought groups to my mind, the things that catapult me into overthinking. This season, I will take a moment in the program to overthink each of the plays. I look forward to your responses and ideas as we meet and engage with one another in this headspace. Seamus Dean, of Nationalism, Colonialism, and Literature, writes, "All nationalisms have a metaphysical dimension, for they are driven by an ambition to realize their intrinsic essence in some specific and tangible form. Although the problems created by such an ambition are sufficiently intractable in themselves, they are intensified to the point of absurdity when a nationalist self-conception imagines itself to be the ideal model to which all others should conform." In Fake, I'm struck by how a group of highly educated men could insist on the authenticity of Piltdown Man for almost 40 years. I would argue that a whittled-down cricket bat taken for a weapon or tool of this Piltdown Man, the first Englishman, is an absurdity that can only be accounted for within a transcendent form of nationalism, a deep desire to believe in the truth of a national character. Isn't it a kind of hubris defined by boundaries that drives nations to invade other countries, to believe our values and our ways of life are superior? The English colonized Africa and Ireland. The Nazis rose to power, and we invaded Iraq based on the truth of our own superiority. One of the real fakes in this play is the truth of a singular notion of a nation. The core of Eric Simonson's play, Fake, is about belief, about our faith in objects to tell the story of our past and present. When we look past the frame for the play, past the objects themselves, I think we see the burgeoning role of nationalism in Europe at the turn of the 19th century. We see the desire of all European countries leading up to World War I to establish not only a delineated, but also a superior national identity. When the play begins in East Sussex in 1914, on the cusp of the Great War, England and Germany are the two great military powers, and the competition between the two nations makes the Piltdown Man discovery particularly important. The idea that the link to modern man is found on English soil is not only a scientific shot in the arm, as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle says in the play's opening, but affirms in the minds of the English that the Englishman came first. This is an archaeological find that suggests a genetic edge for the British over their European counterparts. By 1953, after the devastation of World War II, the notion of a national identity within Europe is thoroughly corrupted. This makes it possible for the great minds of the Museum of National History in England to reconsider their belief in these sacred objects. Perhaps only Teilhard de Chardin anticipated the divisions inherent within nationalism, as his ambitions were less parochial. He made it his lifelong mission to create the Omega Point, an unstoppable evolutionary, biological, and spiritual drive toward one man, one nation. As he says in the play, "To me, there is no such thing as borders when it comes to putting together pieces of the past." Chardin's words presage the value of the internet, Facebook, the way our identities merge together across borders through technology. But do these new tools create a more complicated genealogy through a less fixed notion of identity, or merely flatten our contemporary notion of self